Maine's puffin population back from the brink. Atlantic puffins, those squat little seabirds with the colorful beaks, had once virtually disappeared from this region. But thanks to efforts by scientists, the puffin population is on the rise. Some 1,300 nesting pairs of puffins now inhabit 5 Maine islands. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me and 2 puffin experts to learn more about these unique birds and how they're doing since conservation efforts have brought their population back to healthy levels. But they do still face threats. Climate change is harming their habitat and altering their food sources, and human hazards such as pollution and oil spills endanger their future. Today's program is part of Maine Calling's ongoing coverage of topics that reflect what is iconic in Maine. The outlook for puffins in the Gulf of Maine. Next on Maine Calling, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Puffins are a beloved symbol of Maine's unique wildlife with their colorful bills and cute mannerisms. But these seabirds were once on the brink of disappearing. Conservation efforts, however, are bringing them back. Today, the puffin population is at healthier levels. Join me to learn what's being done to protect them and what threats they continue to face. Joining me in the studio, Linda Welch. She is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist with Maine Coastal Islands National Wildlife Refuge. And Stephen Kress, he's executive director of the Audubon Seabird Restoration Program and vice president for bird conservation of the National Audubon Society. He's also a laboratory associate at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. His work with Audubon's Project Puffin is featured in a recent Maine Public video that you can view by going to our Maine Calling website and Facebook page. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever seen a puffin? Do you have questions for our experts about these distinctive birds? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Linda, let's just start with you to get a bit better picture of what a puffin is. Some people, I think, confuse them with penguins because they're kind of compact and they waddle, but they're not really related, right?
No, puffins are in the family of alcids, which are a group of seabirds that are capable of flight, but they've changed some of their efficiency for flying to use their wings to propel themselves underwater.
And they're very distinctive. They're not like any other bird. Tell me about what some of those traits are that set puffins apart.
Certainly, they're very distinctive. They have a brightly colored bill during the breeding season that's kind of orange and white with some black towards the base, and they have some yellow fleshy bits at the corner of their mouth. And then the rest of them is really striking black and white pattern. Their wings are black, but then they have a white abdomen. And then their feet are anywhere from kind of a yellow to a bright orange color.
But they do waddle. They are like penguins in that way.
They do, and they like to hop around on the rocks. And so they seem very charismatic to watch.
Right. People love them. And Steve, I understand puffins also have a pretty interesting life cycle. They're out at sea for most of the time, and then they come into land. Can you describe that pattern in more detail? And how is it that they're so good at surviving out at sea?
That's right, Cindy. They spend most of their life at sea, and I don't think they would come to land at all if they didn't have to lay an egg. They seem much more at home at sea, as evidenced by the fact that the young puffins, once they head to sea, spend the first 2 to 3 years without stepping from land.
Oh, and really?
Yeah, and then the parents, when they leave their nesting islands at the end of August, they spend the whole winter at sea, and this is a fact that surprises most people.
It is surprising because they're these little guys, and you think of large sea creatures making it out there on the open water. What is it about puffins that enables them to do that?
Well, they have all the adaptations that we would hope that a ocean-loving bird would have. First of all, they have perfectly waterproof feathers. Even though they are sitting in the water, they don't get wet. The water just sheds off their back, and you look at them sitting on the water, and they're not wet at all. Perfectly waterproofed, good layer of insulation by their downy feathers and layer of fat underneath that, and they can drink salt water. They can sleep on the surface of the sea. They can dive under when they get hungry. It's everything they need is there, and when we think about it, what it takes for a human to live on the ocean, it's amazing that a seabird can just float all year long at sea.
That is amazing. And I understand the diving is also a pretty amazing trait. Describe how they are able to catch fish.
So they can slip under the water with using their wings, like a penguin uses its wings. The puffin wings turn into like flippers underwater. Open part way, they chase little fish. They snap up little fish in their beak, and apparently they hold the first part of their catch with their tongue against the roof of the mouth, and then they drop the lower mandible to snap up another fish and another fish and another fish. And when they're feeding their chick, this helps them bring whole loads of fish from food-rich areas back to the chick. Five or six at a time is normal, but the record is actually 61 fish in one beakload.
How do you know that's the record? Were you there to see it?
I did not see that. It was a British record, so we'll have to trust that it was true. But apparently the bird was captured in a net, and someone actually picked up and counted the 61
Oh, my gosh.
Fish.
Well, you mentioned the chicks, which I learned the cutest word is puffling, right? That's what they're called, the chicks?
That's right.
Talk about a little, Linda, maybe explain how that nesting works when they do come on land and they have these little nests. It's only once a year, is that right?
Yes, they start coming ashore on the breeding colonies. And in Maine right now, we have 5 islands that support breeding populations of puffins. The birds generally start coming ashore very late in April or May. The majority of puffins in Maine nest under rocks. Some of them are very large boulders. It could be the size of a car. And then other pairs also will excavate burrows back into the soil, and they'll use their bill to kind of chisel away at the dirt and then kick the soil back out with their feet. And some of those burrows could go back 10 feet or so into the soil. So it depends on how much soil is present on an island. A lot of our main islands don't have a lot of topsoil, so the birds are nesting under rocks. The birds mate on the water, and then they'll lay one egg per season in that burrow. Both parents will tend the egg and incubate it for about 35 days, and then the chick will hatch. And both parents take care of that young chick. They'll brood it until it's a couple of days old and it can thermoregulate by itself. And then they both spend most of their time actively trying to find food for that chick.
Good parenting.
They are good parents.
And they do mate for life?
They do. We certainly try to keep track of them. We place bands on the bird's legs so we can identify which island they came from and how long they live, and identify which birds are breeding with which other individuals. And they do return to the same burrow with the same mate.
Huh. Well, speaking of chicks, we're going to take a listen to what a puffin sounds like. Let's hear a little bit of sound here. Okay, so what kind of puffin are we listening to there?
Be an Atlantic puffin.
Okay. Oh, that's right. And we are talking about Atlantic puffins.
And there are many, or several kinds. In the Atlantic, we just have one in Maine. In the Pacific, there's 3 species. But anyways, I'm pretty sure that's an Atlantic puffin.
Is it a chick?
Yes, it is a chick. And that particular call is a hungry call.
Okay.
Not super hungry call. Just it's sort of reminding the parent that it's there and it's ready to receive fish.
Huh. So over time, I'm sure you basically understand their language because you've both been doing this for a long time.
We are always learning.
Okay. Then let's test you on another sound, okay. And you can tell us what that is. Here's another one. Okay, that sounds like a revving motorcycle, not like a bird. Is that actually a puffin?
That is. That's an adult puffin. And you often hear that sound from within the burrows. And in faint in the background, you could also hear a chick vocalizing. So sometimes the adults will communicate to each other with that call, but I've also heard the adult doing that to the chick.
So that wasn't angry or anything like that. It just sounds like that.
Yes.
Very surprising, I think, to people.
Yeah, I think the birds recognize each other, the individuals, by their different tones.
And just like people.
Yeah, and it's kind of a way they have of recognizing the mate, incoming mate as well.
Okay, and we mentioned these are Atlantic puffins that we have here in Maine. Right. Linda, maybe you can give us a sense of the puffin populations that are found worldwide.
Certainly. They breed across Atlantic puffins across the North Atlantic, with the largest populations being in Iceland. But then they're also breeding kind of in Northern Europe. So the Gulf of Maine represents the southern limit of the breeding distribution on the Western Atlantic. But there's large populations in Newfoundland, and the largest populations occur in Iceland.
Right, millions now. Of them,
yes,
there.
Millions, yes, millions.
So they don't have a problem with not enough puffins.
No, they are facing challenges, though, with finding sufficient food to raise their young. And they are finding that a lot of the colonies aren't able to produce chicks in certain years because there simply isn't enough food to raise their chicks.
Well, that was one of the things we looked at in selecting this topic, was what a dramatic difference there was here in the Gulf of Maine in terms of the puffin population we're seeing now and in the past. So, Steve, maybe you can kind of take us back through history a little bit on how bad things got for puffins.
Right. So at the turn of this century, that is the early 1900s, previous century, the puffins were almost extirpated from the state of Maine. It's thought that there was only one or two pairs at Matinicus Rock at the low point, maybe another 50 pairs up on the Canadian border on Machias Seal Island. But essentially, they were gone because people love to hunt them for food and for feathers. You can't get a lot of feathers off of a puffin, but they take them as part of the byproduct of capturing them, mostly for food. And I don't think that the people that were doing that were ill intent. They were just looking to find food to eat. It was a very subsistence time, and after eating dried codfish all winter, a puffin in the spring probably was pretty good by comparison. Anyways, they were depleted completely from almost all the islands except for the two that I mentioned, and they weren't the only ones. It was the terns, the razorbills, the gannets, all these species that were at the southern limit of their range, were hunted either for food or for cod fishing bait, and they were gone. And so the fact that we have puffins there now is an exciting change, and that is because they're protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which was started in part because of this hunting period in 1918, and also because there were some focused, directed efforts to try to restore colonies of puffins, which was the subject of your earlier documentary. And that program started at Eastern Egg Rock in 1973.
You're being humble. That was you. You're the one
True.
Who did that.
I came on that idea, and we, with the help of a lot of young enthusiastic college-age students, we have continued that project ever since on Egg Rock, and then in 1984 expanded to Seal Island National Wildlife Refuge, which we manage with the refuge. So it's very exciting to see these colonies grow and to see them increasing, even though the environment on the coast of Maine is changing. And we're seeing that the puffins, because they are able to adapt, they are also vulnerable, as we've seen in Iceland. The decline that Linda mentioned is because there's changes in the water temperature, and the fish are not as available as they used to be. So now the puffin is actually endangered in Europe. When we started Project Puffin, that was unthinkable because they were in such healthy, large colonies on the other side of the Atlantic, and here we were struggling to have any puffins at all. Now, there are still millions there, but they're older, and they're not reproducing as well as they used to. So they are at risk in Europe. And here, our populations are alternating in their success from year to year.
Okay. I wanted to, since you did mention getting started with Project Puffin back in the 70s, could you kind of walk us through what you did to bring them back here?
Okay. I'll try to give you...
I know. It's hour right there.
No, it's a fascinating story, and I'll try to give you some of the highlights. We based the restoration project on the fact that young puffins, it was known, return to the island where they hatch. And we decided to focus our effort on the puffling age, when they were about 10 days old. And so with permits from the Fish and Wildlife Service and from the Canadian Wildlife Service and other agencies that now protect the puffins, we got permission to first move six chicks in 1973, 50 in 1974, eventually moving 100 a year, and eventually a total of about 1,000 chicks to Eastern Egg Rock by 1986.
And all along waiting to see if they would come back.
Right. And they didn't come back for about 4 years until we started putting up decoys on the rocks.
Huh.
And the combination of decoys and an increasing population of birds with a memory encouraged a few to land. And eventually in 1981, 8 years after we started, we had our first puffling hatch on Eastern Egg Rocks.
Wow, that must have been exciting. And you kind of faked them out, huh, with the decoys?
We faked them out with the moving them at hatching age almost, and then the decoys as a second level. Yeah.
And then the momentum took over from there, where they started really realizing.
We haven't had to translocate any puffins since. We still put a few decoys up.
Mm-hmm.
But they become their own decoys,
huh.
And they are attracting other puffins, not just the translocated birds now. All those birds have passed on to the great puffindom in the sky, but we have now attracted other birds, some all the way from the Canadian border on Machaya seal, others from Matinicus, others from seal, and we've learned that it's not as simple as we thought, where they would all go out, they would all come back. In fact, they come back to the vicinity. So the translocation helped to establish puffins on different islands as well as Egg Rock.
Wow, what an accomplishment. What about you, Linda? I know you've also been doing a lot to restore the puffins. Tell us about your work.
Certainly. As Steve mentioned, the Fish and Wildlife Service worked with National Audubon Society to translocate puffins to Seal Island. And so now there are very robust populations on Matinicus Rock and Seal Island in Outer Penobscot Bay. But we've also seen puffins colonize Petite Manan Island off Steuben in Washington County. And there was no historical record of puffins nesting on that island. But it seems like the predator-free environment that the Fish and Wildlife Service created through our management, it was an active common Arctic and roseate tern colony, and we think that enabled the puffins to move in. There was suitable habitat, and that remains a smaller colony. We don't have as much breeding habitat for them, but we this year had about 70 pairs of puffins on that site.
And are they doing well?
They are doing well, yes.
How do you measure that?
So we actually keep track of how many of the burrows have an egg in it. So it's an occupied burrow and their breeding pair. Then we go back and determine how many of those eggs have hatched to look at a hatching rate. And then we weigh and measure the chicks at different intervals to look at their growth rate and kind of estimate how well they're doing based on the diet that they're getting. So we monitor what food is being brought in. And then we band them so we know exactly where they came from and when they hatched. And then we determine how many of those birds survived to leave the burrow. And one of the really interesting factors, I think, about puffins is that it takes them about 50 days to reach the age where they're independent. But when they get close to that stage, the parents stop feeding them and leave them on their own. And the little puffins wander out of their burrow at night, walk down to the ocean, swim out into the ocean, which they've never seen or experienced before, and then figure out that they need to dive, sometimes down to 60 meters, to find food and feed themselves. And so it just seems like a phenomenal accomplishment.
That's tough love.
It really is.
I'm about to send my daughter to college. That sounds like the same thing. Wow,
yeah.
That's fascinating. So they just instinctively know what to do.
Instinctively know what to do, but it still surprises me so much
every
that
time.
They're capable of doing that. So many other seabirds have some level of parental care.
Go ahead. You can keep talking.
Okay. After the fact, and the adult birds will continue to provide food once the chicks leave the island and provide some level of parental care. But the little puffins are on their own and have to figure it out.
Sounds both fun and crazy.
Yes.
Well, we just need to take a quick break right now. But when we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. and Fallbrook Woods, a Maine-owned assisted living community in Portland, supporting the unique needs and individual styles of those with memory impairment.
As the trade dispute with China drags on, leaders in China aren't sure they can trust the U.S.
If we make a deal, can this deal really work? There are lots of questions.
That story and the latest out of the G7 meeting happening in France this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio. There's a good chance the online Maine Public Community Calendar lists something you might be interested in doing, or maybe several things. You'll find it online at mainepublic.org. And if you represent an organization, you can list your event there for free as well. Concerts, exhibits, hikes, dinners, lectures, outings, events of all stripes and colors, and all searchable by date, location, or type of event. Visit mainepublic.org and click on Events and then the Community Calendar.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, the puffin population in the Gulf of Maine and how conservationists are seeking to protect these seabirds. Joining me, Steve Kress, Executive Director of the Audubon's Seabird Restoration Program, and Linda Welch, Refuge Biologist with Maine Coastal Islands National Wildlife Refuge. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And we were just talking about the amazing efforts to bring these puffins back, and now here they are. How are they doing, for example, this summer? How can you gauge the population right now, and what's the status of them?
Well, We think this was a very good summer for puffins, and it started early with most of the puffins laying eggs at least a week earlier than they usually do, which is, gets them off to a good start. One of the challenges that puffins face in the Gulf of Maine is that the Gulf of Maine is warming. And some have said that it's warming faster than almost any other ocean in the world.
Right.
And so here we have these cold water northern birds at the edge of their range, so naturally they are going to feel that change, literally. And the fish that they feed on feel that change. So a lot of it, their success, it seems to be closely related to the temperature of the water, the sea surface temperature. And that affects the fish. When the water warms on the surface, the fish go deeper, and then it becomes more difficult for puffins to capture food.
And you're seeing this, Linda, too, as well, that they're not getting fish or they're getting different kinds of fish?
A little bit of both. In some years, they're just not able to find sufficient amounts of fish to feed their chicks, and then a lot of the chicks perish.
Oh.
Last year, in 2018, it was a very unusual year where we saw the ocean temperatures in the Gulf of Maine warm considerably later in July when the puffin chicks were still in their burrows. And often when we've seen that happen in the past, the adults abandon the colony and the chicks die. But there must have been just enough food around to keep the chicks alive. But a lot of them stopped growing for 3 to 4 weeks during this warm spell in the Gulf of Maine. And then the water temperature dropped back down in mid-August and the chicks started growing again.
Huh.
So it took them much longer to reach that level of independence and fledge from their burrows. But at least it was a much more successful season than we had previously thought it could be.
So there's some level of adaptability to what's happening around them. But if it's just a constant warming trend, would they move to different places? Or what kind of adaptation would they do in the long term?
It's possible. As Steve mentioned, these birds are at the southern limit of their breeding distribution here in the Gulf of Maine, so they are inherently more vulnerable to some of the threats that we're talking about. And certainly availability of forage fish seems to be a big issue. In 2013, we had a very warm summer, and only about 10% of the puffins were able to raise a chick that year. And that kind of was across the board in all the colonies. And so that was a pretty dramatic episode for us to witness, where you kind of had large-scale mortality throughout the colonies for both puffins and terns, too, and other seabirds. They just simply couldn't find enough food.
That was the first year that we really became aware that climate change had caught up with us. We'd been hearing about it. and others, oceanographers, have been talking about a trend that started at least in 2010 and probably before that. But since about 2010, there's been a consistent pattern of warming. But in 2013, it was in our face, and it was exactly what we were seeing in Norway and in southern Iceland. And we thought, oh, is this the new normal, or is this just this year? And so we started watching very carefully. And what we're seeing is that it's climate change and puffins. It's much more complicated, and perhaps that's because we are able to watch it very carefully. And the change that Linda mentioned, year to year, we're seeing that you never know, and which makes our work very exciting because
exciting,
there's so many variables. Exciting, but at the edge of our chair, like, what kind of year is this going to be? And we never know. There's clues ahead of time, like at the beginning, the egg laying early. That was kind of a good clue. Of course, it's all related to bigger changes, not just the sea surface temperature, but melting of Greenland.
Oh, yeah.
And changing the amount of water and the salinity of the water and the pH of the water and changes in the Gulf Stream, which is a big factor that pours warm water into our normally cold water. And the amount of that has an effect on the plankton and the size of the plankton bloom, an effect on the fish. And overlaid on top of all that are the fisheries impacts, because some of the puffins' foods are the same foods used in other commercial fisheries. And our success at managing fish is therefore also affecting this mix of climate and fisheries, and the puffin is sort of caught in the middle of all this. And what they do tells us much about what's happening with both the climate and the fisheries.
So they're a little bit of a canary in a coal mine. If you can watch what's happening with the puffins, it indicates more about the environment.
It's a good analogy. It's an indicator of the health. And now, for the first time, the information we're getting about puffins in the Gulf of Maine is using in a NOAA State of the Ecosystem report as an official indicator. And that's very exciting to us because we've worked hard to get the attention of the fisheries people who are more accustomed to going out and dragging nets through the water to capture fish and sample the water. But fish are very good about getting away from nets. They're not as good about getting away from seabirds because they've had millions of years of figuring out how to capture fish, and they're good at it.
Well, we've been talking about climate change and the environmental threats, but what about human-caused threats like pollution or the potential for oil spills? Are those something that's really kind of posing is weighing on the puffin population?
Thankfully, we haven't had to deal with any major oil spills in this region, but it certainly remains a risk. In Newfoundland, they kind of have chronic oiling issues for a lot of their seabirds, and they think it might be the result of some of the tankers discharging bilge water. So in many years, they find thousands of different seabirds washing up on the shores of Newfoundland. And we did have an oil spill off the coast of Virginia a number of years ago, where it killed razorbills, which are a relative of the puffins, and the Fish and Wildlife Service received money to try to work to restore puffins and razorbills here in Maine to try to recover some of those birds that were killed by that oil spill effort. So it certainly remains a threat.
And pollution?
Certainly environmental contaminants are a real issue for a lot of species. These birds are feeding at higher levels in the food chain, and there's certainly more contaminants showing up in the environment all the time. So we kind of routinely monitor some of the contaminant levels in some of the seabirds, and mercury in particular seems to be one of the toxins that seems to be increasing in some of the seabirds in this region.
Okay, let's go to a call now. Stacy is calling from New Harbor. Hi, Stacy, you're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Cindy. Thank you for taking my call. This is such a fascinating show. Learning so much. I'm a boat tour operator out of New Harbor, Maine, and I've been running puffin tours for 26 years, and my company's been affiliated with Steve Kress for about 31 years, and 26 years ago when I started, we only had 14 nesting pairs of puffins in 1994, and this year, I believe, Steve, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think we ended up with 188 nesting pairs of puffins.
Is that right, Steve?
You got it, Stacey. That's terrific. Yeah, the Hardy Boat's been a big help to Project Puffin.
So describe what you do when you take people out.
So our Puffin watch is about an hour and a half and takes maybe 20 minutes to get out to Eastern Egg Rock. I'm a very Eastern Egg Rock-centric puffin person. and we circle the island during the nesting time. The island is protected. We have terns that just lay their eggs in sort of open, rocky nests, and we don't want people stepping on those eggs and killing those birds. So we circle the island several times, and we often see the puffins in the water preening and cleaning themselves. They'll do something that we call pinwheeling, so you'll see them in the air flying in these circles and sort of spinning around the island. We'll see them up on the rocks, and it's really exciting to see. We sort of, because the puffins arrive here in April, when we bring our boat up from Yarmouth where we keep it, we will often stop by Egg Rock and sort of check in and see what's going on. And this is before Steve's people are kind of on the rock, and we'll find puffins at that time of year. So towards the end of April, we know the puffins are there, and we start running by mid-May. And it's fun for us to witness the birds go through their whole progression. And we know through Steve and the people working on the island when the eggs are hatching, and we've got pufflings, and you'll start to see the adult birds, you know, flying in with fish. And Steve and Stacey Puffin are on our boat, and they narrate the whole trip. So they'll talk about all the details of what they've done there.
That's terrific. And I'm assuming you manage people's expectations that they're not going to get too close, right? Is it usually through binoculars that they're seeing the puffins?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of dynamics. You had mentioned the comparison to penguins. I think when we see pictures of puffins, they're usually, it's a single puffin, like in this picture frame, and it's hard to judge how big they are. Puffins are small birds, and they're only, you know, 10 inches or less, you know, 8 to 10 inches tall. So they're very small birds. They're kind of robust birds. They're round and kind of pudgy. But, yeah, we do have to kind of remind people that we are going out to see pretty small birds and bring your binoculars. And if you don't have some, we actually rent them on the boat because it is a necessity for puffin watching.
Stacey, I just had one more question. Have you seen a change in the interest level of people who want to come see puffins? Is there any trend happening?
I think there is, only because the word is getting out. I mean, the puffins, people have always been fascinated by puffins. And, you know, I'm an ecotourism business, and the birders love to check off their, you know, their bird species on their list. And Atlantic puffins are one of those birds. The only place in the United States you can see them is here in Maine. So there's a high degree of interest, and I think as the populations have increased in Maine and they've become more of an icon and something that people, part of our language here in Maine, chickadees and puffins and moose, and I think there's definitely more and more interest every year. But, I mean, I hate the word cute, but it really applies to the puffin. They're so darn cute, people really do want to go out and see them, yeah.
Great. Well, thanks for calling, Stacey. That was good to learn about that. And Linda, I believe you do this too. You're involved with some tours for people. What do you do?
Yeah, certainly. There's a number of tour boat operators. There's a few individuals that operate out of Millbridge and take trips out to Petite Manan. But the largest visitation occurs through the Bar Harbor Whale Watch Company out of Bar Harbor, and they do a combination seabird viewing and puffin, and whale viewing trip. And we've tried to work with them by placing cameras on the island so that the people on the boat can get a close-up view of the seabird nesting island, and then they can broadcast that image on their plasma screens on the TV. And we also have two-way radios so that the guests on the boat can ask questions of the researchers on the island about what they're doing or, you know, what's happening with the birds on that particular day. So it kind of gives them a more intimate experience.
And do they usually get to both see whales and puffins, or what's more likely that you get to see?
Well, during the nesting season, puffins are generally kind of a guarantee right at the breeding colony. I know this year a lot of the whale watching companies are indicating they have to go all the way to Canada to see whales because there's simply no whales present in this region because they're not finding enough food.
Okay. And so that, again, is something where people don't expect they're going to get on the island and hold a puffin or anything like that. They just at least appreciate being able to view them.
And that's one of the challenges that we face as seabird colony managers, as these islands are closed to public visitation during the entire breeding season to protect the birds. But we want the public to be interested and engaged and supportive. And it's a challenge when you're telling them, but you can't go and land on that island. So that's something that both Audubon and the refuge, I think, struggle with, is to get people, you know, passionate about these birds and care about their future and care about their conservation, but at the same time respecting those island closures.
Okay, great. We'll talk a little bit more about what you can do to help puffins or how you can get involved after the break. We're just going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Farmland Trust, celebrating 20 years of growing the future for farming. Share your stories and get involved at MaineFarmlandTrust20th.org. And Otelco Cloud and Managed Services, helping Maine businesses manage IT systems and business communication. Learn more at otelco.com.
Hello, I'm Jane Wales, host of World Affairs. From the time we wake up to the time we go to bed, technology is always at our fingertips. And on the flip side, we're always on technology's fingertips. Next on World Affairs, Shoshana Zuboff joins us to discuss how big tech is collecting and selling our personal data, often without our knowledge.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock in just a few minutes right here.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a series of interviews with this year's Emmy Award nominees and two Saturday Night Live alums. Bill Hader stars in HBO's dark comedy Barry as a Marine veteran turned hitman who starts acting classes. And John Mulaney, who wrote for SNL, had his own award-winning comedy special. He's nominated for hosting SNL. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're learning about Atlantic puffins and how their population is doing in Maine. Joining me, Linda Welch with Maine Coastal Island National Wildlife Refuge and Steve Kress with Audubon's Project Puffin. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. Linda, you just mentioned how taking people out there to the islands gets them more interested in conservation. I think, Steve, you had some other ways that you kind of get people hooked through their interest in puffins in actually getting involved. What kinds of methods are there?
Certainly for people that are in Maine or visiting Maine, the best way to do it is to go out to the islands and get close and see the birds flying around. There's nothing better really than the real deal view. I might add a visit to the Hog Island Audubon Camp is another way to do that. We have week-long programs about seabird conservation. We visit puffin colonies as part of that program as well. But if you are not in Maine and still want to get your shot of puffins, you can watch the puffin cams. And there are several of them, and they're all on Seal Island, a National Wildlife Refuge. The first one we put in about 2012 was on a puffin loafing ledge. That's where puffins come to loaf and spend time. It's a social place, gathering place, and you see them parading around above ground and interacting. But my favorite puffin cam of all is the puffin burrow cam. This is a cam inside of a burrow. And you see the parent puffins setting up the nest in the spring. You see when the egg is laid. You see them taking turns incubating. You see the chick hatching. You see the parents bringing food, first tiny fish and then bigger fish. You see how the male and the female take turns raising that chick, how they tuck it under their wing to keep it warm, and they preen it. And all these details on the the Borough Cam. It's on explore.org. And we learned an interesting thing this summer, that Borough Cam watchers are keeping track of the number of feedings and the kinds of fish, and they told us amazing details about what's going on in that borough that they're seeing from all over the world. About 50 countries. Yes, it's sometimes called citizen or community science, and it's people collecting data and reporting it back to a science center of some sort, and then we learn together about the birds.
Do the birds figure out there's a camera in there and peck at it or anything like that?
Well, sometimes they see. I think they see their reflection maybe in the lens, because you'll see them come up, look at it sideways, pick at it occasionally, but I think it's not intrusive really, and it just gives us an amazing window on wildlife. It's an exciting window, but it's also a reality check when the parents are not finding enough food. These cam watchers are the first to report there's a problem, and we second that by our researchers that are living on the island, and it's usually not just one burrow; it's the whole colony. So this is a view, really a snapshot view, of what's happening colony-wide.
Linda, is there similar efforts going on where people can get involved in some way, or how they can help with what your efforts are?
Certainly. We are also establishing a visitor contact station in Rockland, where people can come in and learn about the efforts of the refuge to conserve seabirds. And we work closely with Friends of Maine Coastal Islands, which is a friends group that supports the refuge activities. And so they generate interest and help fund some of the work that we're doing on the refuge. So that's one way we encourage people to get involved if they want to help to contribute to what we're doing on the islands. But again, we encourage people to watch those videos. The explore.org videos are fantastic. And they actually run all winter long and show that Seal Island National Wildlife Refuge is also a really important spot for gray seal pupping. So you can watch in January as those animals are giving birth, and it's brutally cold, and you see bald eagles out there. And so it just shows the tremendous wildlife value of some of those islands that we've conserved.
And I was going to ask you about that, because while you're out there with the puffins, there are a lot of other species you're simultaneously working on. What are some of the other ones?
Certainly, those islands are really diverse habitats. So there's common Arctic and roseate terns. That are utilizing the islands that we've now established as predator-free sites. In addition to the puffins, there's black guillemots and razorbills. There's leach's storm petrels, which are these fascinating nocturnal burrow-nesting seabirds that are utilizing some of these islands. There's common eiders. There's laughing gulls. On some of the other islands, there's also blackback and herring gulls, double-crested cormorants, and great cormorants. So these islands are really diverse ecosystems.
And were all of those other species at some point facing threats as well and have come back, or does it just depend on which ones you're talking about?
Most of them did face similar challenges in the late 1800s, early 1900s, from people collecting feathers for the millinery trade or use as food and bait. And some of the challenges that the terns are facing is that they benefited from protection of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, did well for about till 1930, 1940. And then the really rapidly increasing populations of blackback and herring gulls kind of started to eat the other seabirds off the coast of Maine until the late 1970s, when a collaborative effort between the Fish and Wildlife Service and Audubon and Canadian Wildlife Service and our state partners all joined together to try to reestablish these colonies.
You both mentioned the hunting that went on in the past, and that still happens in Iceland, right? They still do catch puffins for food. Can you describe? I've seen videos of how they catch them. Can you describe that, Steve?
Well, it's a very traditional kind of hunting where people will go out on cliffs, and usually with long nets, with long-handled nets, and they will try to capture the flying birds. I think the people that do it liken it to almost an athletic kind of experience. If you think
lacrosse.
It reminds me of lacrosse.
Oh, no.
Yes. And so they do this, and they have been doing this, and it's passed on from generation to generation. At the moment, in southern Iceland, there's a halt on that. How long it'll stay that way, because It's ironic to be capturing birds to eat that are listed as endangered and have not been breeding and are aging. So, but I don't think that that's not the problem. It's actually a distraction from the problem because it's so conspicuous. The relatively small numbers that are taken are not nothing like, you know, a whole year class of millions of puffins not producing.
Uh-huh.
Or producing young that are not well fed and are emaciated. I mean, puffins have adaptability, but there's only pushed to a limit. So the real issue is climate. And the climate is changing. It's warming, and the currents are changing, and the puffins are suffering. I'm often asked, well, can the puffins just migrate northward and mm-hmm. shift their range north? The problem is that puffins require specific quality nesting islands. They have to be a certain distance from the mainland so that there's no predators on them. They have to be safe from animals like mink and raccoon. And so there's only so many islands like that. And as you go north, there's not that many islands. There are some, and the puffins will hopefully survive there. But I think the real question is, will the puffin adapt to the changes around it? And to help it adapt, we need to look at our fisheries to make sure there's enough fish left in the sea. One of the ways to have climate change affect less is to have a healthy, diverse food base for seabirds. And if there's many kinds of fish in the oceans, then the puffin's likely to find something to eat.
Right.
And we're seeing that now with the increase in the haddock. Haddock is a recovering fish stock. Most people now see it on the menu wherever you go. It wasn't always that way. But the haddock is having a resurgence, and it's because of the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act that is a good, solid baseline that's helping to recover fish stocks to prevent them from being overfished. So the fishing people of our coast are benefiting, and so are the puffins, and it's a great thing to see.
Great. We have an email question from Josh. How far do puffins typically range from their home islands? We've seen individual birds near Isle of Haut and Mount Desert Island.
Well, I can speak to that from a project we just started this summer where we put little GPS tags on some of our puffins at Matinicus Rock and found they were flying this summer up to about 25 to 35 miles for the longest distances, mostly to the south. But Isle of Haut is not that far from Seal Island, so it's well within the range of feeding from Seal Island birds. So he could easily be seeing Seal Island birds coming over to feed at Isle of Haut. And remember, there's several young age classes of puffins that just spent all their time on the water, flying from island to island.
Having fun.
Yeah, taking it easy before they're committed to raising a chick, yeah.
And I think you touched upon this, but how far can they fly? They've got these little wings. It looks like a lot of effort when they fly. Are they good flyers?
They definitely look like they're putting in a lot of effort to fly. So it's a very rapid, strong wing beat. You know, and so they're not long-distance migrants. Some of the terns that we work with, the Arctic terns, are going all the way to the Antarctic on an annual basis. And common and roseate terns are flying to Brazil and Argentina. So those birds are designed for tremendous long-distance flights, where the puffin certainly is capable of flying. As Steve mentioned, you know, routinely could be, you know, 30 to 50 kilometers to find food. Obviously, if they don't have to go that far, it's to their advantage. If you need to feed your chick 10 times a day, it's a lot better for you to not have to fly that far. But we did a similar tagging effort this summer with terns, and sometimes they were flying 50 kilometers to find food.
Huh. What do you say to people? I know there's probably critics who say there's all these resources and efforts going towards this very specific bird species, and that's not as important as helping human species. What would your answer to that be?
My answer is that it's not one or the other. We should be looking after humans, of course. But we also need to look after the birds, and we should realize that without our help, we will lose species. In fact, we live in a time of extinction where more species are disappearing now than ever before. And it's because of humans. We are a huge force of extinction. And I would argue that we should also be a huge force of conservation and restoration, because we have that ability if we set our mind and our resources to it.
How did you pick puffins in the first place?
I think I kind of fell in love with puffins at Machias Seal Island, where I spent some of my younger naturalist days. And I saw them, and then when I came to Midcoast Maine, I realized they used to be here, and that seemed a terrible loss, and that's what sparked my interest in the restoration of puffins. And now we know how to restore puffins, we can restore other species too. These methods that we used for puffins are now used worldwide, and that's the other argument that I would put to people, is that yes, the puffin is still a common seabird in some parts of the world. In trouble, for sure, because it's an indicator species. But the methods we've learned are now helping at least 64 other species of seabirds around the world. And some of those are critically endangered, like the Chinese crested tern. They were thought to be extinct, but now there's a program in China, modeled after our program in Maine, that has restored this population up to about 90 pairs as of this summer. So we're hopeful that the lessons learned here in Maine have wide impact. It's our job to be stewards of the life on Earth, and each of us can make a difference.
What about you, Linda? What drew you to seabirds or puffins in particular?
Maybe a little bit less direct path. I did my graduate work studying bald eagles in Maine, and basically fell in love with the coast of Maine and coastal islands. So I worked on endangered species for a number of years for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and then I was given the opportunity to transfer to the refuge and work on seabirds. And I found that incredibly rewarding because you see the direct benefit of your conservation actions. It's right in front of you, and I have a hard time thinking of maybe another job in wildlife where you have that level of accomplishment or satisfaction, or sometimes frustration, because certainly not everything goes well all the time. But it's really nice to feel like you're making a difference in trying to help species recover.
Well, on that positive note, that's it for today. But thank you so much. Clearly, your conservation efforts have paid off. Linda and Steve, thank you for joining us today. Linda Welch is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist with Maine Coastal Islands National Wildlife Refuge. And Stephen Kress is executive director of the Audubon Seabird Restoration Program, vice president for bird conservation of the National Audubon Society, and a lab associate at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. You can see him in action by checking out the video by Maine Public's Susan Sharon and Brian Michard on our Maine Calling website and Facebook page. This show is part of Maine Calling's ongoing coverage of topics that are iconic in Maine. Nikki Shields ran the board today, Sandra Harris took your calls, and we had additional technical help from Scott McCallum. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.